Peter B. Collins. News and comment. It is Friday, September 20th, 2013. Back when Joe McCarthy was rampaging on Capitol Hill in the 1950s, hunting for communists, his committee was called the House Committee on Un-American Activities. And we need a new incarnation of the Un-American Activities Committee to discipline the radical members of the Republican majority in the House of Representatives. So what they're doing is frankly un-American, and hopefully it will not stand. It will be unraveled when many of these contentious pieces of legislation originating from the Tea Party right and beyond the control of Speaker John Boehner will be dead on arrival in the United States Senate. But in round one yesterday, they rammed through about $4 billion a year in cuts to the food stamp program. And this is simply mean-spirited. It is class warfare. And they even have created a new kind of welfare queen. This time, it's a kind of shiftless surfer dude from Southern California named Jason Greenslate. He lives in the area near Tony La Jolla, right there on the Pacific coastline of San Diego County, and he drives around in a pickup truck, and somehow he qualifies for food stamps. And there's a video that's been making the rounds in Republican circles showing this guy buying lobster and sushi with his $200 a month in food stamp benefits, living the rat life as he described it. So they have an anecdote, and I'm certain there is more than one case, of people who abuse their access to food stamps. But thousands of people, including veterans, the elderly, and children, will be denied food stamps, and we have a high level of people in this country who are what's called food insecure, in the language of the bureaucrats, and it means that they don't know if they're going to have three meals today or three meals tomorrow. And I credit the Democrats for some theater of their own. Jackie Speier, the congresswoman from the San Francisco Peninsula, showed up on the House floor with a can of caviar and I guess a steak. I don't know if it was cooked or not. But she described how members of Congress who receive millions of dollars in farm subsidies then go off on junkets and charge the taxpayers for very expensive meals, including caviar and vodka. And while she observed the niceties of the House and didn't name names, she was specific enough about these cases that crafty bloggers can identify who these Republicans are. But the effort to shame Republicans is useless because, of course, we know they have no shame. And I want to credit my office neighbor and my co-host of the local TV show that I do on cable access here in Marin County, lawyer Larry Strick, for careful reading of the New York Times story about this vote. Because in addition, the bill will restrict people enrolled in other social welfare programs from automatically becoming food stamp eligible. And not only that, it will allow states to require food stamp recipients to be tested for drugs, and get this, to stop lottery winners from getting benefits. The Senate bill apparently contains a similar restriction on lottery winners. Now, since when did it become a crime or some sort of a black mark to win the lottery? After all, these are government programs favored by Republicans as a way of taking money out of people's pockets, and maybe some of it trickles down to education or other purposes. And the language here is very vague. How much do you have to win in the lottery before you're ineligible for food stamps? I mean, you win a scratcher, $2, $5? They probably wouldn't know about that. That's a kind of all-cash transaction. But what if you're lucky and you win $1,000 once in a state lottery? Are you banned from food stamps for life? And these are the people who deplore and decry what they call the liberal nanny state. Oh, example, when Bloomberg put the limit on large soda containers in New York City. That's government overreach. That's micromanagement by government. And what the hell is this? Now, I don't even agree with the point of restricting people with drug penalties, drug convictions, from food stamps. Because often people are driven to the drug trade because they have no other choice. And later in this podcast, we'll tell you about some decent efforts by the Attorney General, a man I rarely find cause to praise, to roll back the draconian minimum mandatory sentences related to drug offenses. And so this is an incoherent offset to that. But it fits, as George Lakoff would say, the strong father mentality of today's Republican Party politics. In a moment, an update on a report about domestic spying and the waste of taxpayer dollars, the intrusion on the lives of innocent people. We'll get to that in just a moment. But I always like to thank the people who support this podcast by signing up for subscriptions. People like Aaron Gimbel up in the Pacific Northwest, Beth Daniel, Ray Welch here in California, and Mark Brodsky in Illinois. Thank you all very much. And if you have not taken out a subscription, why don't you pause right now and click on over to peterbcollins.com. Right under my picture on the upper left-hand corner of the homepage, follow the link that says sign up. You can get a 24-hour pass for $1. It's $5 a month, cancel anytime, or sign up for our best deal, the annual $50 subscription, and I've still got bags of Kona coffee for new annual subscribers and a few copies of Sybelle Edmonds' powerful book, Classified Woman. You know what to do, so what's holding you back? The other way you can support this program is by steering your web business to GoDaddy.com. We've got a deal where they split some of the new revenue with me when you do business there. And if you sign up for web hosting with unlimited storage and bandwidth, the rate starts at just $1.99 a month, and they'll throw in your domain name free. Get that special deal. Follow the link at the top of the show file for this podcast at peterbcollins.com. Well, here in Northern California, the American Civil Liberties Union has just concluded a study and published a report on the so-called fusion centers. And I want to credit Bo Hodai, the very intrepid independent journalist who helped us understand the role of the Joint Terrorism Task Force, which is run by the FBI and the feds. They set up these regional fusion centers. There are 70 of them around the country. And this is intended to coordinate the federal law enforcement efforts with state and local police agencies. On paper, makes sense. You close the gaps. You have a kind of unified approach. But the truth is that these agencies waste a lot of time and money collecting useless information. And they are also used to penetrate honest and law-abiding groups who use their First Amendment rights to protest the government, protest banks, or other groups. And that's what Bo Hodai very carefully and in a detailed manner disclosed. So, the subject of this report is what the FBI calls suspicious activity reports. In one case, they filed a report because a group of Middle Eastern males bought several large pallets of water in Bakersfield. A woman was caught taking photos of the post office in Folsom near Sacramento. Middle Eastern men were found taking suspicious photography of the federal courthouse in Sacramento. And another Middle Eastern man was applying for a pilot's license in Sacramento. So the ACLU obtained 1,800 suspicious activity reports that had been filed in the fusion centers in California, in Sacramento and Los Angeles, between June of 2010 and June of 2012. And what it shows is that these fusion centers live up to a critical description offered by a Senate committee last October. The fusion centers produce predominantly useless information. They flout federal guidelines on collecting personal information and have uncovered zero terrorist plots. That would be zero. And they don't honor the Fourth Amendment where there has to be some probable cause before they file a suspicious activity report. And when you link this to the 15,000 paid informants that Bo Hodai and Trevor Aronson have disclosed to us, many of those informants focused on those thought to be Muslim, it's a kind of racial profiling. And the bottom line here is zero terrorism plots have been busted using this very invasive police state structure. A love letter from Keith Alexander to the large family of people who work in the spook community for the NSA and the other tentacles of our defense and intelligence networks. We are writing to you, our extended NSA family, in light of the unauthorized disclosure of classified information by a former contractor employee. That would be Ed Snowden. We want to put the information you are reading and hearing about in the press into context and reassure you that this agency and its workforce are deserving and appreciative of your support. Yes, the NSA is a victim. Did you know that? The letter goes on, some media outlets have sensationalized the leaks to the press in a way that has called into question our motives and wrongly cast doubt on the integrity and commitment of the extraordinary people who work here at NSA, your loved ones. It has been discouraging to see how our agency frequently has been portrayed in the news as more of a rogue element than a national treasure. Ouch! Whoa! It is a rogue agency. And how can anybody ever consider a spy cluster to be a national treasure? It may be a necessary evil, but I can't imagine anyone who thinks of it as a treasure. It goes on to repeat the phony claim that the work of the agency has contributed to keeping the nation and its allies safe from 54 different terrorist plots. We know that's bogus. We know they can't prove any one of those. The only two cases that they've offered details about were a handful of guys in San Diego who wanted to send less than $10,000 to Al-Shabaab, and a group that's never been really detailed that had some plot against Wall Street. Those are hardly significant terrorist threats. And in New York City, the protests continue over former general and CIA chief David Petraeus, who's teaching a course at the City University of New York as part of his personal rehabilitation effort. And the story made the Guardian UK today, and it was first reported by our friend and colleague Steve Horn, and we covered it 2 days ago here in the Peter B. Collins podcast. Six students were detained on Tuesday as they demonstrated outside an event being attended by Petraeus. They were charged on Wednesday with multiple offenses, including disorderly conduct, riot, resisting arrest, and obstruction of governmental administration. And it's pretty clear from the videos that these were peaceful protesters and that the cops plucked people out of the crowd to harass, arrest, and in some cases, beat. This has produced a negative reaction toward Petraeus from people on staff at CUNY. A letter's been circulated with dozens of signatures that reads, "As graduate students and educators of CUNY, we express our outrage at the violent and unprovoked actions by the NYPD against CUNY students peacefully protesting the appointment of war criminal David Petraeus as a lecturer at the Macaulay Honors College. We deplore the use of violence and brutal tactics against CUNY students and faculty who are protesting." And this article in The Guardian notes that originally they offered Petraeus $200,000 to teach a course one semester, 3 hours a week. After outrage was expressed, they cut it back to $150,000, and then they reduced it to $1. in order to remove money as a point of controversy. Now, some people appear to be offended because protesters were chanting at Petraeus, calling him a piece of shit. Now, I think that's protected First Amendment speech. It may be crude and rude, but you know, the drone strikes that Petraeus ordered, both as a commander in Afghanistan and as head of the CIA, that's really rude. Really, really rude. And the work of a piece of shit. The closing part of the statement reads, "We call on CUNY to terminate Petraeus' appointment and to ask for the charges against these students to be dropped immediately." You may know that members of the U.S. Naval Academy, three football players, have been accused of raping a female midshipman. And this is a tawdry story. But so is rape. Rape is extremely ugly. And the victim in this case is now on trial because of the way that military justice proceedings called Article 32 are handled. The victim has been on the witness stand for 30 hours. And defense lawyers in the military have much more latitude than in civilian courts to grill the victim and essentially look for ways to say that it was her fault. So we know that the victim in this case went to a party. She was drunk before she got there. She continued to drink. It was a yoga toga party. And you can argue that she should have used better judgment. But that doesn't mean that she deserved to be raped by three different football players. And so the questions that she is being asked are, did you wear a bra? How wide open was your mouth during oral sex? And did she apologize to another midshipman with whom she had intercourse for being a hoe? And this is so disgusting. The questions about oral sex technique came from a female lawyer, Commander Angela Tang, who represents one of the suspects, 21-year-old Eric Graham. A lawyer for one of the other defendants asked whether she wore a bra or other underwear to the party and whether she felt like a hoe afterward. And regarding the oral sex part, the prosecution maintained that her technique would indicate whether she actively participated and therefore consented. And this just underscores that the work of Jackie Speier, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, the demand for prosecuting sex crimes in the military outside of the military command chain, it's very clear that needs to be done, but there is great resistance in the military and among military sympathizers in Congress. Over at the Washington Naval Yard, we have another case where the media gave us excessive coverage of a murder spree, a shooting spree, and we see changes in the narrative within just a few days. And this isn't the first time. It happened in Newtown, Connecticut, the Sandy Hook Elementary School, where the real-time live coverage subtly changed, and in some cases not so subtly, in the days afterward. But we're not allowed to ask any questions or be skeptical about which version of events we're supposed to believe. And so now we turn to the BBC, the British Broadcasting System, which reports that members of a Capitol Police tactical response team showed up at the Navy Yard within 16 minutes of the report of shooting. And they were told by Metropolitan Police officers, top brass, that they were the only police on site who had long guns. And their help was requested in stopping the gunman. But when the Capitol Police team radioed their superiors, they were told by a watch commander to leave the scene. Now, I don't know what's going on here. And I'm not prepared to issue any indictments, but you need to understand that we're not getting a straight story. And it appears there was either confusion or a turf battle that took place as people were being shot, wounded, and killed by what we're told was a lone, crazed gunman. And James Comey, the new FBI director, said that it took about 36 minutes for armed police to arrive at the scene. In his sequence of events, there is no mention of the Capitol Police CERT team. They're like a SWAT team. Now we learn that there's been a change in command of that group, that the typical debriefing of that group has not taken place, that several members of the team who were turned away from the Navy Yard have asked for a personal leave to deal with whatever it is they're going through. So, again, I don't know. I wasn't there. I don't pretend to be, you know, a long-distance expert on this stuff. I'm just saying that what we were told changes, and we really deserve to know the truth and not a shifting set of narratives. Next week's going to be a busy one at the United Nations in New York. Front and center, Iran is presenting a new initiative. After we learn now there were some back-channel letters exchanged between Hassan Rouhani, the new president of Iran, and President Obama, starting about 3 weeks ago. Now, there's no scheduled meeting between Rouhani and Obama at the UN, but that could change. And I take Iran seriously. Don't believe everything Iran says. But we know that this whole drama over Iran wanting a nuclear weapon is a narrative promoted by Israel and Bibi Netanyahu. And it doesn't square with our own intelligence estimates going back to 2004. And so I am open to a diplomatic solution of this standoff. And if Iran will allow nuclear inspectors more latitude and really prove that they're not pursuing a nuclear weapon, the sanctions should be lifted. But bloodthirsty Bibi is on his way to New York with his red crayons to draw another red line. And he's spitting mad. He dismisses as media spin the statements from Rouhani about the goals of his nation's nuclear program and his willingness to engage in diplomacy. There is no need to be fooled by the words. Statement coming from Netanyahu's office. The test is not in what Rouhani says, but in the deeds of the Iranian regime. Netanyahu described Rouhani as a wolf in sheep's clothing. So what do we call you, Bibi? A hawk in hawk's feathers? And, you know, the hypocrisy of Israel is really clear. It's now, you know, in motion that Syria will sign the Chemical Weapons Convention if it follows through on the Russian brokered deal to give up its chemical weapons. And a group of regional nations in the Middle East, Arab states, have proposed a resolution at the UN expressing concern about Israeli nuclear capabilities. And so we have Israel hectoring and lecturing other countries about weapons of mass destruction, while everyone knows they're sitting on a stockpile of nukes themselves. And a lot of people can justify a case for Israeli possession of nuclear weapons. But the double standard is not lost on most people in the Arab and Muslim worlds. So it's going to be very interesting to see if Obama yields to Netanyahu's ravings, and as usual, the U.S. takes a posture which is making our foreign policy whatever the radical foreign policy of Israel is at the moment. It will be a very interesting week at the UN. John McCain got an op-ed in response to Putin's op-ed in the New York Times, published in the Russian newspaper Pravda. And immediately it set him up for jokes from Vladimir Putin because Pravda's old school. Pravda means truth. The other paper of the Communist Party was called Izvestia, which in Russian means news. You may have heard this joke before, but there's no Izvestia in Pravda. There was no Pravda in Izvestia. And after McCain published a nasty attack on Putin, and Putin is no angel. There are plenty of things to attack there. It's just not very diplomatic. And it doesn't necessarily advance American interests for John McCain to rail against Putin in Pravda, which has very little circulation in Russia today. And it was Putin who pointed that out, just to kind of ding McCain a little bit. So what did McCain say? Well, he said that he is pro-Russian, but Putin is presiding over a failed petro-state. He's a quasi-dictator who rules by corruption, repression, and violence. Well, that's fair. Not helpful, but it's pretty accurate. And so McCain also weighed into disputes over Russia's most recently enacted law against public homosexuality. And this has produced a legitimate, justifiable reaction among pro-gay interests in the West, talking about maybe boycotting the Winter Olympics in a Russian city coming up this winter. But McCain trotted this out, saying they write laws, he's referring to Putin's government, they write laws to codify bigotry against people whose sexual orientation they condemn. Now, that's what his Republican colleagues have been doing for years. And McCain has been silent as bans on same-sex marriage and other anti-gay moves have been used cynically by Republican election operatives to get Republicans elected. So, the end of the day, it was a pissing contest. And McCain stinks more than Putin. Interesting analysis of yesterday's announcement of the almost $1 billion fine levied against J.P. Morgan Chase for the failure to manage the units in London that lost over $6 billion in bad trades. The headline reads, once again, punishing the bank but not its top executives. And this is rare when the New York Times, which tends to either be neutral or positive about Wall Street folks, makes this interesting point. Now, as I noted yesterday, there's a little difference in that J.P. Morgan Chase actually admitted wrongdoing, which is rare in these white-collar investigations and settlements. But the Times is absolutely right that Jamie Dimon and other top executives deserve to be prosecuted or removed from their executive positions at the bank for failure to do their jobs. The Obama administration is moving forward with EPA regulations on the emissions from power plants. Gina McCarthy, who I thought was going to get stranded before being confirmed as head of the Environmental Protection Agency, announced a proposal, and they published this. There's a whole public comment period, and then they can go into effect. But the proposal will limit new gas-fired power plants to 1,000 pounds of carbon dioxide emissions per megawatt hour and new coal plants to 1,100, which is roughly half of coal plants' current emissions. It's a range, but just to simplify it for you. So this is progress. It doesn't solve our climate change problems, but if we can reduce emissions from those dirty coal plants that we call clean coal, or Obama does anyway, then, you know, we will be making progress. But it'll take a lot to get these regulations actually into effect. over at Fukushima. I give credit to pro-nuke Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. He went to the site of the radioactive power plants that melted down after the earthquake and tsunami. He donned a hazmat suit and a gas mask. And we don't know exactly what he toured at the plant, but hey, he went there and he took a look. And as he left, he ordered TEPCO, the utility, Tokyo Electric Power Company, that runs Fukushima, to decommission the reactors that did not melt down. There are a total of six there. Four of them were damaged beyond repair, but number five and number six were still functioning. And to his credit, Abe has told them to shut down, to decommission reactors five and six, so that they can concentrate on cleaning up the accident at the other reactors. While we're in Japan, we'll note that Caroline Kennedy is going to be breezing to confirmation as the next U.S. ambassador to Tokyo. And honestly, it's not a big deal. I'm glad that she wasn't appointed to replace Hillary Clinton in the United States Senate. She has no experience that would serve her there. And really, all Caroline Kennedy has is her royal name and a legacy. And so it'll be interesting to see if there are any moments that really call on her skills as ambassador to Japan for the remainder of Obama's second term. We'll be watching. Couple of quickies. Eric Holder is actually following through with what he articulated recently about trying to dial back the war on some drugs. He has notified his prosecutors around the country to curtail efforts to prosecute people in ways that trigger these minimum mandatory sentences. So he's instructing them to eliminate the amounts of drugs that are in an indictment, to avoid going for these penalties. It says here, in cases where a defendant has been charged but guilt has not yet been determined, prosecutors will be directed to file replacement criminal complaints to eliminate references to specific quantities of drugs that would trigger a mandatory minimum sentence. Well, good for you, Holder. I rarely find anything to praise you for, so let today be a very special day. And finally, my heart goes out to the pension holders in the city of Detroit, who are likely to be the ones who bear the brunt of Detroit's bankruptcy. We're told there's over $18 billion in long-term debt. We cannot possibly take it out of the hides of the bankers, those who hold the bonds. And so we're going to punish those who worked for the city of Detroit for as long as 30 or 40 years and rely on a pension that averages about 18 or 20 grand a year. And we will consign those retirees to a new state of poverty in the city of Detroit so that we can make sure that the bankers get their due. Thanks for joining me today for my news and comment. You are authorized to share this podcast far and wide. I hope you will. Thanks.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until